Florida is the golf capital of America. There are about 1,000 golf courses in Florida, more than anywhere else in the country. Palm Beach County alone has more golf courses than many states. Many of these courses are part of condominium developments, and many Floridians live on houses that adjoin a golf course. Golf is a driving force in the Florida real estate economy and a link to understanding the way of life for many people in South Florida. John Strawn is a former historian and an avid golfer. His new book, Driving the Green, The Making of a Golf Course, is a step-by-step account of the creation of one South Florida golf course, a course that is part of an expensive residential community. And by studying one golf course, Strawn has also uncovered something about architecture, nature, politics, and money.
Most golf courses now are built as part of residential real estate developments. The developers call them amenities. They're like a marina or a ski slope, tennis courts. They're mainly now engines to sell the real estate. It causes some problems in design. It makes frequently for golf courses that I don't like to play because they're narrow, they're constricted on either side by housing. The old courses, all you did was play golf on them, and I think they're more fun to play. But nobody can afford to build a golf course like that.
Can you describe a little more how golf courses are changing, the ones that are built in the middle of a housing development, how they compare with golf courses that are just golf courses standing on their own?
Well, I think that the major difference is in what the golf course architects would call the routing. They have to try to maximize the number of house lots that are situated on the golf course. The way you do that is to have single fairways would be the maximum way of doing it. If you have houses lined on either side of every fairway, that would maximize the real estate. It would also make terrible golf. So frequently what they do is a compromise. They'll have double fairways or parcels of fairways with housing around it. But the contemporary real estate design golf courses, they may be maintained better or as well. They may have green complexes and fairways and tees which are equal to older courses and maybe in some cases superior to. But for somebody like myself to play down a canyon of housing is not pleasant. I prefer the old courses where you can spray the ball around a bit, where what would be called a core course. So everything is the golf course. On these residential courses, there's out of bounds on either side. You're going to land in Harry's pool if you hit a bad shot.
Golf courses look like very well manicured, but otherwise, you know, fairly natural open green spaces. But you describe how really difficult it is to create that kind of landscape, especially in South Florida. Is that kind of lawn really alien to the natural environment there?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing, I think, remotely like it. But that's true for not just for South Florida. It's more dramatic in South Florida, I think. South Florida is dead flat. And unlike other parts of the country where there's some features in the natural topography, everything, every hillock, every mound, every bit of movement in the ground in a South Florida golf course is created by the architect. That's part of the reason I wanted to write this book about a South Florida course, because the artifice would be so obvious. In South Florida, all the movement of the excavation of the lakes and the placement of the dirt, it just creates a landscape that clearly is not native. In addition to that, as you mentioned, you know, the grasses, lawns are not really a natural feature of the landscape. In South Florida, the grasses that are used on golf courses are all hybrid Bermuda grasses, crosses between grasses that come from Africa, and there's nothing like them in nature at all, whether in a landscape or anywhere else.
South Florida has gotten so developed that the golf courses are among the only really open green land left, aside from like the Everglades, but I mean in the developed parts.
Right.
And, you know, the golf courses are a kind of landscape that's pretty alien to the swampland, to the wetlands that they're built on. What effect are the golf courses having environmentally on the area? Any?
Well, you know, they don't have to be.
It's preserving open space.
Right,
and yet
that's
it's
right.
A different kind of, different kind of ecology than is natural to the area.
That's right. It's interesting. They don't have to compete with the wildlife. They don't have to compete with the environment in a terribly damaging way. Arthur Hills did a wonderful golf course on the southwest coast of Florida called Bonita Bay. What he did was to, instead of making the whole golf course a giant lawn of 120 acres, from every tee to every green being lawn, he carefully placed the tees sort of adjacent to the wetlands, made them small, and then on a tee shot, the players are required to hit the ball out over a wild area, as it were, onto then a smaller lawn-like area, which constitutes the fairway. So Bonita Bay has perhaps 65 acres of maintained turf, as opposed to the 120 or 130 acres that a typical course has. And in extreme cases, like a course I saw in Texas, one of the savings and loan boondoggle courses, which, since it had unlimited money, felt free to just develop all the turf land it wanted, has 300 acres in turf, which is an absurdity. But it is possible to create a golf course which is not damaging, in fact can enhance wildlife habitat. I think the permitting agencies, the biologists in the South Florida Water Management District or in U.S. Fish and Wildlife would love to be able to work with developers to assure some adequate protection of wildlife. But the whole system is kind of set up to see that doesn't happen. To what degree golf courses represent or sort of a villain in this piece is kind of hard for me to judge. I think compared to agriculture, for example, golf has been had a trivial effect on the environment of South Florida compared to sugar, for example. But I think it would be, I think it's in the long run, golf developers, architects, everybody in this business, they're going to have to be sensitive to these larger sort of issues. And that means they're going to have to accept playing on brown grass at certain times of the year, not putting a million gallons of water on the golf courses every day when water is a very precious commodity, and make those sorts of compromises. I mean, golf doesn't have to be played on the perfect, pure lawns that American golfers have come to expect.
You're a golfer. How did writing this book change your feelings about the sport?
Well, I think they didn't really change my feelings that much about the sport of golf itself. I still find it wonderfully companionable. I love going out with my friends and playing. I play on public golf courses. I'm not a member of a country club, and I really prefer that for a whole bunch of reasons. I think there's a tendency to confuse golf with kind of its management and its settings, and I think it's important to me not to sort of brush golf with the damaging tar of racism, sexism, of anti-Semitism, of all these things that are very much a part of the golf's heritage in the United States, but are not part of the game any more than the fact that universities also once practiced most of those social habits should be now scorned rather than admired as places of learning. So I love golf for the good things. I think it's really, truly a democratic game in the place of its origin, that it is a game which I would like to see restored sort of to its democratic purity in the United States if we could.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it very much.
John Strawn is the author of Driving the Green, The Making of a Golf Course. This is Fresh Air.